Texas in the fall of 2003 to work with the Dallin Road Church. Pat Riley was the youngest of the six men who were serving that church family as shepherds at that time. And I have to admit that I just didn't know what to think of Pat the first 6 months or so that I was there. The elders met regularly on Wednesday nights before services, and Pat would come walking into the meeting in his white tennis shoes and his blue jeans and his golf shirt, and he would go over to the corner and he would sit on the floor, and that was his perch for the elders meeting. That just didn't seem like an elder to me. He wasn't like any elder I had encountered before. And as he sat there in the corner on the floor, he had told the guys in the room that he was the sergeant at arms in the elders meetings. The other guys would want you to know that there was no such position among the elders in that church family. It was a title that Pat had given himself. And it wasn't the only title he'd given himself. He also called himself the songbook elder, but that's another story. I won't go there this morning. But basically, what he meant when he said he was the sergeant at arms was that if he ever felt like one of the guys was kind of rambling on about something and generally just getting off the subject and going on and on, Pat reserved the right to put a stop to that and to call the guy out and get him back on track and to get a decision made. And if you're sitting there thinking, that sounds like that could be really awkward. Yeah, it could. But Pat was one of those guys, and you've surely met someone like this. Pat could just say anything to anybody and then flash that big cheesy grin of his and everything would be okay. Pat and I lived in the same little town, just north of Beaumont. And so when there was some kind of a leadership event, he and I often rode together. And over the first year or so, we did a lot of talking with each other. And found that we were just of the same mind about so many things. And pretty quickly, Pat and I became friends. It was just about 2 years after moving there that Pat was getting close to the age of 50. And he went in for some of these kind of routine medical tests that guys get when they get to 50. Did I say all I need to say about that? You understand, right? Routine kind of stuff. But the results were not routine. And so there was some more testing and those results were bad. And then there was a procedure. And by the time all of that got done, Pat was confronted with the grim reality. Here was a 48-year-old man diagnosed with a very aggressive metastatic cancer. It was already moving throughout his body. And the doctors where we live in Beaumont sent him home to die and told him, you've got 6 months. And he wasn't content with that prognosis, and so he went just a little way over to Houston, where we have world-class medical facilities, and the doctors there at MD Anderson were quite more optimistic with him, said, we know some things we can do that'll push back this cancer, and we can fight this, and you never know what's coming along, and they believed they could extend his life for a good deal of time, maybe many years to come. But essentially, the prognosis didn't change. They could fight it and push it back, but it wasn't going away, and eventually it would win. Pat described his condition as long terminal. He was going to die. And it all changed him. I don't want to imply when I say that he was not a good elder before his diagnosis, but Pat said many times he was a much better elder after his diagnosis. I still remember when he called all of us together, the leadership team, to tell us about his condition. I remember that because in the meeting, he looked around the room and he said to all of us, he said, we are withdrawing from people in this church family and I don't even know who they are. And he said, now that I know that I'm going to die and that I have to give an account before the chief shepherd, he said, guys, one of two things has to happen to this leadership team. Either we got to change the way we do business, or I need to resign as an elder so I can get ready to meet the Lord. And so among the men in the room that night, there was an agreement and we would change the way we did business. And I want you to know, Pat led the way in all of that. He got his nose in God's book and what God says that an elder is really all about, not a church administrator, but someone who takes care of sheep. And he read some things that had been written about that, and he used all that information together to put together presentations in our leadership meetings, where for several years we carefully studied what it was that God had in mind when he called men to shepherd his flock. But I don't want you to get the idea that for Pat this was all theory, because even as he learns these things, he's out trying to be that to his people, to build relationships among his sheep. So he's studying and he's getting to know his sheep, and he's battling cancer all at the same time. He developed a special relationship with our college kids. I'd asked him to teach that class, and he reluctantly agreed to do it. And from that time that he went in and taught the college class, he never left their class again until he wasn't able to attend anymore. Even when he wasn't teaching, he was still in the college class keeping an eye on his sheep, his young sheep. In fact, the college kids gave him a title, and I guess you know how he felt about that. They called him the scholar in the corner, because that's where he would sit, over in the corner on one side of the room, even if he wasn't teaching. I don't know why they called him that. Pat was not a scholar, not in any way. When I was stuck teaching the class and he was in the corner, I had a different name for him. I called him the tormentor in the corner. You can see how that's shaken up, right? Because what Pat would do is, if he ever felt like we moved past some tough question or some difficult place in the text too quickly, he put a stop to that. And he would say, wait, David, verse 33, that's the hard verse here. Go back and talk about that one. That's what he would do to us. In those years that intervened, we did a lot of praying for Pat. I prayed for Pat. I told God a bunch of stuff that he already knew. Pat was helping us. In fact, the truth is, the influence of his work was beginning to extend beyond our congregations, and there were other churches who were learning about our work on this leadership model and were wanting to know about it, and already we were beginning to share what we were doing with others who were trying to do the same thing and get back to that biblical model, and he was making such a difference. And so I prayed Hezekiah's prayer, that God would extend his life. Toward the end, it got really bad. The cancer was in his bones. He was suffering terribly. One afternoon, I was called up to the hospital. His wife had taken him to the emergency room. And as I was walking up to the hospital, I met up with one of his loved ones who happens to be a wayward disciple. And as she and I walked into the emergency room together, she unloaded on me, folks. She just said, I want you to explain to me why God is letting this happen to Pat. He's such a good man. He's doing so much for the kingdom. Why would God let him suffer this way? And I will just tell you, folks, I struggled to reply. Truth is, I was wrestling with the same questions. We lost him in May of 2011, 6 years after that initial diagnosis. And I was left with all my questions. Why did Pat Riley die? It just seemed to me that if there were ever going to be a time where God was going to intervene and heal, that this was the time that was supposed to happen. Why didn't God heal him? And why is it that there are other people who are wicked people who are living long lives? At the time that Pat died, Hugh Hefner was still alive, lived into his 90s. Why did Hugh Hefner live to be 90 and Pat Riley died when he was 54? That just seems so unfair, doesn't it? Please know that I am not the only one with a story. In fact, I fear that as I share mine, probably all I've done is stirred up your own story that's in your heart, maybe brought a few tears to your eyes as you thought about your own suffering. And if you're thinking, I don't know, I don't have a story, you probably don't have gray hair either. Hang in there. You live a little while. And you're going to have a story too. And you're going to have to wrestle with the same question. And ultimately all of us have to wrestle with, why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good, dedicated disciples get terrible diseases and linger and suffer and die? And if God is what Psalm says that he is over and over again, our rock, our fortress, our deliverer, where was he when I needed him? I will tell you, brothers and sisters, questions like these pose a threat to our spiritual foundation. It is the number one reason for unbelief. When Barna asked people, what is your greatest barrier to faith? Their answer was, I have a hard time believing that a good God would allow so much evil and suffering in the world. There it is. We're not the only ones who wrestle with it. And so I think we need to spend some time talking about the problem of suffering. And it's not unrelated to the other things that you have been studying through the course of this year. In fact, it may be the number one thing that threatens to destabilize our spiritual foundation and become a barrier to us believing, the problem with suffering. And then when it's close to home and it's not dying children in Africa, but it's my family or it's me, how do we deal with the problem of suffering so that it doesn't destabilize our faith? I want to try to help with that today, but it is 5 minutes till 11. How long do you guys want to go? It's a big topic. So I'm going to go a little long this morning, but I promise you I'll give it back to you this evening. Is that a fair deal? But you only get the bonus if you come back tonight. I want to talk to you about the problem of suffering and tell you about some things that I think we need to consider before we blame God and we decide that God has let us down and didn't do what he said he wanted to do. I want to identify several of those things, but listen, we're just going to skirt across the surface this morning, okay? Think of these as apps on your phone. All we're going to do today is install them. Give us some things to think about when we're suffering, and then when your time comes and you have a story, you'll have to go back and you'll have to dig deeper than we have time to do today. For this morning, I just want to give you the list. Some things we need to think about when we encounter suffering and we are tempted to be disappointed with God. So I'm going to begin with this. Number one, before I allow myself to believe that God has let me down, I think I need to ponder my expectations. Can we start there? Because I think sometimes the reason we are disappointed with God is because we expect things from God that he never promised to us. I think sometimes people believe that because they are walking with Jesus, that life ought to be easier for them, right? If I'm a servant of Jesus, I ought to always have a good job. I ought to always make plenty of money, and nobody should ever get sick that I love, right? And you hear me say that and you think, no, that cannot be true. That's not the way it is. And we know that. And yet still sometimes that's what we expect. And when it doesn't work out that way, when those are our expectations, we decide, well, that God has let us down. But I do wonder, why do we expect that? Why do we think it ought to be so? Does the Bible teach that? Folks, that's not what I see in my Bible. When I read the Bible, I find all kinds of examples of good, godly, dedicated people who suffered along the way, right? We could just go back and camp right over the book of Job. That would do the job, wouldn't it? Then you think about some of the Old Testament prophets like Elijah and other prophets who suffered terribly. You get to the New Testament. Think about the New Testament disciples who received the book of Revelation and all that they were going through. When Paul wrote to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 3 and verse 3, he says we're destined for affliction. Sometimes we're not just suffering the difficulties that come with life, we're suffering because we're walking with Jesus, right? The Bible does talk about a time when there will be no more mourning or crying or tears. You know where that is, right? Revelation chapter 21, verses 3 and 4. What's it talking about there? It's talking about heaven, not life on earth. And sometimes that's our problem. We are expecting heaven on this side of eternity. And brothers and sisters, God did not promise that. So sometimes before I decide that God has let me down, maybe I need to consider my expectations. Am I expecting from him something he never said that he would give me now, heaven on earth? But I'm not completely satisfied with that answer. Adjusting our expectations still leaves me wondering, well, why can't life be better now? Which brings us to a second app I want to put on your phone this morning, and that's this. We also need to think about the consequences of free will. Because that's one of the reasons life now can't be better. Because human beings are given free will by God. And many take that free will and they use it to do terrible, evil things. And sometimes their evil intersects my life and brings grief and suffering to me too. Y'all remember 4 or 5 years ago, the story of the depressed German co-pilot? He was up in the air and the pilot got up and left the cockpit for a minute. And when he left, this depressed co-pilot locked him out. Do y'all remember this story? And he took that airplane and he flew it right into the ground. 153 people died. It was a terrible story. And you can almost hear the atheist say, well, why didn't God do something about that? Think of all the grief and misery, thousands of lives impacted by that one man's choice to do evil. And the atheist would say, you see, that's how we know there's no God. Because if there was a good God, surely he would have intervened and done something about that. And I'll tell you what the atheist knows when he says that. He knows that he is making simple something that isn't simple at all. He's taking something complex and trying to make it simple. Let's just follow that line of reasoning. My question is, why are we stopping with that airplane crash? If for God to be a God that I can believe in and serve, he should have stopped that. Why not every choice a human being makes to do something that will harm other people? Why didn't God eliminate all of that? And why are we stopping there? Why does it just have to be a choice to do evil? Why not eliminate anything that might bring pain and suffering to someone else? Eliminate all forms of physical ailment, all forms of cancer and heart disease and diabetes. Get rid of all that too. And listen, God could do all of that. God could intervene and prevent us from doing anything evil or harmful. Goodbye to free will, because now we're just robots living out our program. You see the problem? Brothers and sisters, we live in a broken world where human beings are using their free will to do terrible things. Is it reasonable to believe that along the way we will not be impacted by that? So we've got to ponder that. Before we decide God has let us down, we've got to think about the consequences of free will. Now let me go in a completely different direction. Did you guys, ladies, did you wear your steel toe pumps this morning? Because this next one's kind of tough. But we have to put this on the list, okay? The next one on the list is this. I've got to think about my part in my troubles. Right? There's a fascinating exchange in 1 Kings 18 between the wicked King Ahab and the prophet Elijah. There's been a terrible period of drought for several years that Elijah had predicted, and God sends Elijah to meet up with Ahab and tell him the drought's coming to an end. And so in 1 Kings 18, the two of them come together, and as they meet up, Ahab sees Elijah, and he says in verse 17, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" I gotta laugh when I hear that. I hear Ahab saying that and I think, come on, really? And Elijah corrects him as well in verse 18. If anyone's making trouble for Israel, it's not Elijah who's just God's spokesman. It's this wicked king that's leading them into idolatry. But Ahab is either unwilling or unable to see his own contributions to his troubles. You see the problem? And let's not be too hard on Ahab, because we are really good at that. In fact, Americans have turned this into an art form where we can find a reason to blame everybody else for the problems that are in our lives. So this is where it gets a little tough. If I take all of the financial blessings that God has given me and ignore all the warnings in Proverbs, and we could recite those this morning if that's what the lesson's about, all of the warnings about saving for the day of trouble and being careful with our financial blessings. If I ignore that, take all my financial blessings and spend it up enjoying and indulging my desire for stuff, and then I'll pull out MasterCard and Discover and charge huge debts, getting even more stuff. And then, as the proverb writer warns, the day of trouble comes. I lose my job. And immediately I'm in trouble. I can't pay my bills. And I look at God and I'm like, where were you to rescue me? Is that really God's fault? Or if I spend 20 or 30 or 40 years of my life abusing my body with drugs or alcohol or cigarettes or even food, and I get into my later years and I begin to have health issues and I begin to suffer as a result of those health issues, is it really fair to look at God and say, where were you? Why are you letting this happen to me? When we choose to act foolishly and ignore His counsel and we do foolish things and suffer as a consequence of that, folks, we need to be upset with ourselves, not with God. In fact, that's the beginning of the process of fixing it. Until I acknowledge that I'm causing the problem, it's not ever going to get better, right? By the way, that's an answer for the atheists who complain about the babies who die in Africa every day. You realize atheists talk about that. Sam Harris has made a whole cottage industry going online and complaining and writing books about how awful it is that God allows babies to die of hunger every day in Africa. My question for the atheist Sam Harris is, if you're so worried about those dying children, why don't you do something about it? Why don't you get off your book tour, take some of the royalties, and get over to Africa and feed the babies? It isn't like there isn't enough food. He's pointing the finger at God. It would be more appropriate for God to say, where are you? And why aren't you doing something about this? Sometimes men blame God when they need to blame themselves. All right, we need to press on because we've got some more apps to put on the phone. Number four, I think we need to consider God's timetable. Before I get angry at God, feel like He's let me down, I need to consider His timetable. We talk about that all the time. In the Psalms, there's that phrase that's used again and again, like in Psalm 27 there at the end. It talks about waiting on the Lord, right? Do y'all sing the song, In His Time? Isn't that a great song? That used to be among my very favorite, and I have to admit it was among my favorite because I didn't really pay attention to what it was saying. Have you ever really thought about what that song is saying? He makes all things beautiful exactly and right at the moment I want Him to. That is not what that song says, is it? And I have to tell you that as I've really pondered its message, I like it less. It's a hard song. In His Time is great theory when it's just lyrics in His song. But when I'm sick and I'm waiting on the Lord for healing, or when I'm jobless and I'm waiting on the Lord to help me find a job, suddenly In His Time is hard, isn't it? Here's a deeper issue here that just has to be probed and thought about more, and that's the issue of trust. You know, folks, prayer is not a way of getting what we want from God. Prayer is a way of entrusting things to God and let Him deal with it in His way and in His time. And so Proverbs 3:5 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean in your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight. So I've got to be thinking about the Lord's timetable. Can I give you a little help with that? I don't know how to break up the periods of Joseph's life. In other words, I don't know, after he was sold in slavery, how long it took the caravans to get him to Egypt. And then I don't know how long he was a servant in Potiphar's house before that awful accusation landed him in prison. And I don't know how long he was in the prison exactly. What I do know is that in Genesis 37 and verse 2, when he's keeping his father's flocks, the text says he was 17. And that's when it all started. And I do know that in Genesis 41 and verse 46, when Pharaoh calls him out of the dungeon to interpret the dream, that's the turning point when things start getting better. I do know that he's 30. So we're dealing with what? 13 years, right? Here's my question. Do you think Joseph prayed every day during those 13 years? That God would deliver him. That God would send his daddy to get him out of prison. I'm thinking it was more than once a day, don't you? Man, if I was in his shoes, I'd be praying all the time. That's like 5,000 prayers that went unanswered. 13 years. So when Monday's problems aren't fixed by Friday, and the troubles we had at the beginning of the month aren't resolved by the time we get to the end of the month, maybe we need to sing that song in our head. He makes all things beautiful in his time, right? I mean, he trusts God and let him work it out on this timetable. I'm not completely satisfied when I give you that answer, though, because I think back to Joseph's story and I'm wondering, but why did he make him wait 13 years? Why didn't he just go get him out of prison? Why didn't God, surely God was able to deliver him. Why did he make Joseph wait so long? And so there's a partner that comes with timetable. Let's add this one to the list. I've got to think about God's agenda too. Philip Yancey, in his excellent book, Disappointment with God, makes this interesting observation about the book of Job. He contends that the most important chapters in Job are not all those chapters in the middle where Job and his friends argue about why all these bad things are happening in him. In fact, Yancey even goes as far as to say that the most important chapters in Job are not the chapters at the very end where God finally weighs in, as important as those are. Yancey contends that the most important chapters in Job are the ones you and I know the best. The first two. Because he says it's in chapters 1 and 2 that we learn what's going on behind the curtain. That there's something bigger happening here, which is why Job and his friends can't figure all of it out. They don't know what God's doing. And I just wonder sometimes, if maybe sometimes in our hour of suffering we need to appreciate that God's got something bigger going on that we can't see. I wonder that about Joseph's life. In Genesis 39, there is an interesting thing that the Holy Spirit does in what is ordinarily a very concise book that just strikes me as odd. In Genesis 39, twice the writer gives us Joseph's resume. Have you ever noticed that? If you look at Genesis 39 verse 1, we're told about how Potiphar buys Joseph and how he comes into the house as just another slave and he grows until he's the number one slave in the house. Remember that? It takes about 6 verses to give us his whole resume there. And then, after the incident with Potiphar's wife, he goes to the dungeon, and we're given the same thing at the end of chapter 39. We're told how he goes from just being another prisoner, he rises up through the ranks, and he becomes the number one prisoner. Why twice does the Holy Spirit feel the need to give us Joseph's resume? I think it is so that we will know that God did not forget about Joseph when he was in prison. But instead, God was using those years in Potiphar's house, however long they were, and the years in prison, however long they were, God was using them to take a 13-year-old or 17-year-old boy and mold him to a man at 30 who could lead Egypt. Because that's what's happened, folks. Pharaoh pulled Joseph out of jail at 30 and put him in a position to run Egypt, and he was ready. 13 years prepared him for leadership. God did not forget Joseph. God was just working on something different. And I wonder sometimes if we don't need to look for that too. Listen, listen, I will have to admit that some of the most powerful lessons I've learned in my life have been wading through the trenches of adversity. Suffering is a powerful teacher. Maybe God lets me suffer because there's something He wants me to learn. Or maybe in some way my life will be a blessing to other people. When I look at the way Pat Riley lived after his diagnosis and the impact he had on the kingdom and the way he died and the people who have been changed because of all of that, I've had to wonder, did God have something bigger in mind that I didn't see? You know, Philippians chapter 1 and verse 20. In Philippians 1:20, Paul says that he is willing to exalt Christ either by life or by death. Paul says, use me as you need to, Lord. If I need to live for you and do your work, great. If you need me to die for you, that's great too. How about if he needs me to suffer? I'm okay with that too. Maybe God's working on something bigger. And I don't see it yet. Okay, one more thing and I'm going to be done. Add this to the list. I need to be careful to get the bigger picture. I want to be cautious when I make this point because I don't want to be guilty of minimizing anybody's suffering. I don't want you to minimize my suffering. But I think sometimes we process suffering badly and poorly because we look at it within too narrow a window. We view it too narrow. And sometimes we need to step back and get the bigger picture to illustrate. Maybe you feel like God has let you down financially. You look around you, a lot of people who aren't even serving God, they're just doing well. Your neighbor just bought another new boat and a nice new truck to pull it. And here you are, you're trying to serve God and you're just barely getting by. And you feel like God has not been there for you financially. You take all the financial blessings you feel like you don't have. Write them down, put them on a list. And then turn over to Ephesians 1 and 2 and 3 and make a list of the spiritual blessings that you and I do have in Jesus. How do those two lists compare? In fact, what happens is the more we understand what we have in Jesus Christ, the less and less the other things we don't have seem to be. Maybe that's why again and again we're urged to pray with an attitude of thanksgiving. I have found when I pray, if I give thanks first, my requests shrink. Does that happen to you? Or maybe it's bigger than that. Maybe you're praying for God for healing, and maybe it's not, you know, just some, you know, little inconvenient kind of sickness. Maybe it's a big deal. Maybe it's life-threatening like Pat's, and you're praying for God to heal you, and He hasn't done that. And so you take that and you put that on the list. But on the other side, be sure you write down the healing that God has done, the spiritual disease that He took away in Jesus Christ. How do those two compare? You see it? Sometimes we need to step back and get a bigger picture. I needed to do that with my friend Pat. I finally realized one day that what I was really quibbling with God over was about 2 decades. Pat died when he was 54. If he had died at 74 or 84, I'm sorry if that's where you are, I'm just making an illustration. But if he had died at 74 or 84, we would have been sad, but what would we have said? That's what happens. That's the way we go through life. So really this was about 20 years. And then it dawned on me. 20 years that he doesn't want back. I'm quibbling with God over 20 years that Pat doesn't want back. Pat's not up in heaven saying, I sure do regret that I'm up here with God and I'm not down on earth living out these next 20 years. He doesn't want them back. What am I quibbling over? You see it? Sometimes, folks, we get so consumed with a few things we feel like God hasn't done for us that we miss the bigger picture. We end up being like a little kid at his birthday party with his table piled high with presents and ice cream and cake and candy, and he's throwing a tantrum because mom brought his cake on a blue plate instead of a red one. If all he did was save me, if the only thing I could put down in that column of what God has done for me, if the only thing was that He saved me, it would be enough to be eternally grateful forever. and he's done so much more. And so Paul would say to the Romans, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory that is to be revealed to us." And to the Corinthians, "So we do not give up. Our physical body is becoming older and weaker, but our spirit inside us is made new every day. We have small troubles for a while now, but they are helping us gain an eternal glory that is much greater than the troubles." How childish to overlook the amazing things God has done for us. Worse yet, to put at risk what he says he will do for us in our future, all over some comparatively smaller things that we feel like he did not do. And that may not even be true. Just doesn't make sense, does it? Not when we take the time to step back and get the bigger picture. Thank you. You have been very patient today. And I will apologize because I have not begun to say what ought to be said about all of that. What I hope you'll go away with is this, that this business of men praying in their hour of suffering and God answering and responding to those prayers, it is not uncomplicated, is it? There is a lot that has to be weighed and considered before a person decides that God let me down and didn't do what he said he would do. I hope that we will not be childish and shallow in our thinking about matters that are so important. But that when our time comes and we have our stories, we will dig deeply and think carefully about the complicated issue of suffering. And then this, that we would put our trust in him. Because at the end of the day, folks, that's what all of this hinges on. Do we really believe that God exists? Do we really believe that the Bible is his word? And if we do, will we put our trust in him that in his time and in his way, God will be the rock and refuge for his people? Do we trust him? Do you trust him? Do you trust him in your walk? Maybe you committed to serve him, but day to day your life doesn't look like the life of disciple. Do you trust him? Or maybe you've never let Jesus cleanse you of your sins as he has promised to do. Do you trust that God will do as he said? We're going to extend an invitation right now to let his grace reach you in forgiveness. Do you trust him to do that? Do you need that today? If you do, you make your way to the front right now while we stand. While we sing.